Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is December 22nd, and I'm hoping that, first of all, you are having a magnificent holiday season. I'm also hoping you're going to hear this relatively soon. Today, tomorrow, as soon as I'm done recording this monologue, I am unplugging everything, and then I'm going to be on the road for 17 days, traveling to Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New York. And you might be saying, Brett, some of these sound like the worst states. Aside from New Hampshire, these sound like the worst places to go. Why don't you just go to California? Well, I have reasons to go to all of these places, and I assure you that there's great people that I'm going to be visiting with in each state. But this is the first of these shows that I'll be releasing while I'm on the road. It's a collaboration with my friend Nathan Frazier. You know Nathan. He's been on the show several times in the past, and he is also a contributor to a lot of what happens behind the scenes here. He and I are in a mastermind group together, and I've gotten a lot of great benefit from working with him. So if you want to learn more about what Nathan does, he has a podcast. You can go to NathanFrazierShow.com. Professionally, he works as a marketer and a copywriter. And if you want to get a sense of what he does there and the personal flavor that he brings to that endeavor, you can go to copyandfunnels.com. Nathan also has a community called the Free Market Squad, many of you might have heard of. And the portal into the Free Market Squad is at copyandfunnels.com. So we were talking a couple weeks ago about this T.M. Landry scandal. This is a miracle school, finger quotes, that was featured on things like Ellen DeGeneres and all over the mainstream media, places where people don't do their homework. And then the New York Times did a kind of expose and discovered that this school that seems to have a lot of educational attributes that people in this audience would appreciate was entirely a scam. So Nathan and I are going to discuss that story, but we are also going to dig into the bigger picture of the broken, I guess it depends on who you ask, but I would say as far as parents and students are concerned, the broken public school system, and of course, the corrupt and increasingly disconnected and ideological higher education system that also bears responsibility in this whole story. I'm going to play a couple of media clips here at the beginning just to set the scene. And then we'll move into my conversation with Nathan Frazier, where we look at, like I said, the bigger picture that T.M. Landry fits into. And it's not a pretty picture, but we will wrap up with a silver lining. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Merry Christmas, and I'll update you from the road along the way.
I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars. I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars. No handlebars.
Look at me, hands in the air like it's good to be alive. And I'm a famous rapper, even when the pads are all crooked-y. I can show you how to do-si-do. I can show you how to scratch a record. I can take apart the remote control, and I can almost put it back together. I can tie a knot in a cherry stem. I can tell you about Leif Erikson. I know all the words to De Colores, and I'm proud to be an American. Me and my friends are platypus. Me and my friend made a comic book, and guess how long it took. I can do anything that I want, cause look, I can keep rhythm with no metronome. No metronome, no metronome.
A high school student in front of a laptop, surrounded by classmates, dressed in college gear. A moment of suspense, and then...
Yeah! Yeah! Yeah!
It was a scene repeated over and over again. Students from one Louisiana private school opening acceptance letters from their dream colleges. The videos often went viral. This one, of a 16-year-old student getting accepted to Harvard, racked up over 8 million views. But there was more to the story. Students told us many of their college applications included false information provided by their school's administrators. And the cheers in these videos covered up an ugly reality of abuse and intimidation at T.M. Landry College Prep.
abusing emotionally, physically, we realize, okay, something's not right. Everything is wrong with T.M. Landry.
16-year-old Megan Malveaux is a former student.
There was this little kid, he was probably about 7 or 8, and he was acting up in class. Mr. Mike, he had took the kid by the neck and picked him up and body slammed him on the table.
Mr. Mike is Michael Landry. He and his wife Tracy founded the school. It costs up to $725 a month to attend and received national attention for its 100% college acceptance rate. In various TV interviews, they pitched a message of hope and hard work.
We're changing society. We're giving hope.
Go big or go home.
The Landrys denied falsifying transcripts in college applications and any allegations of abuse. But they do maintain that physical punishments are doled out because they love their students and treat them like family. The Landrys told the story of young Black kids from a working-class community who overcame systemic barriers to achieve success.
Doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter where you've been in life, you can do it.
And the videos were crucial in promoting that message. Parents say they had no idea what was going on.
All the videos, I was excited for all the kids because they're kids. Little Black kids like us. Can go to Harvard, Yale.
I mean, the good talking he did made you realize, man, your kid needs to go to that school. If you want the best for your kid, you need to send him to T.M. Landry. You know, you speak anybody in Louisiana, they're telling you.
When the cameras were off, students say they were pitted against each other, interrogated and humiliated. Students say they were also physically punished. Sometimes they would be forced to kneel on rocks, rice, or hot concrete for hours.
I remember the first time I was put on my knees was because he gave me a test and I failed it.
A New York Times investigation found that behind the scenes, the Landrys filled out transcripts incorrectly to reflect classes the kids say they never took and grades they never earned.
My transcript was messed up because he messed up my birthday, because apparently I was born the year my mom was. He put classes that I never even took, like chemistry.
Students told the Times that the Landrys told them to lie on their college applications about growing up in households marked by poverty, crime, and drug addiction. If they refused, they say the Landrys threatened to do it for them. A look back reveals clues about Michael Landry's temperament, like in this recent pitch that became a passionate outburst.
What's wrong with that issue? Excuse me, ma'am.
But this was a rare glimpse at his frightening tone. The Landrys produced a steady stream of promotional material, painting a positive picture of an unconventional school.
T.M. Landry is a no-frills school.
No classrooms, no walls, no books.
Teachers without certifications. Classes with no teachers at all.
After the acceptance videos started gaining traction in 2016, press from around the country started showing up at their door.
Walking around campus, we saw that weird Landry style.
Outsiders marveled at how the Landrys could make the impossible happen.
So, okay, this is incredible.
The results speak for themselves.
They have figured out Landry's secret sauce.
They really have. Yeah.
In media interviews, they called themselves a family.
Family first.
That pushed kids to their academic limits.
They will make it. No is not an option. Failure is not an option.
Former students and parents told us that for visits like these, students would be forced to spend days rehearsing what to say to reporters.
I plan to attend Harvard University.
Harvard University.
Stanford University.
Oh, Brown.
We have this trig book, which is like from MIT, so we just basically teach each other.
For the high school students, there was a singular focus, practicing for the ACT. For younger kids, a loose and insufficient curriculum that has left many grade levels behind. When their methods were questioned, the Landrys were quick to dismiss any suspicions.
Some of them sound a little brainwashed.
When it's a Black kid and it's strictly education, something's wrong with that kid.
The reason why I never said nothing was because I was scared, because they were getting all this attention from news channels. They were in articles. I was so brainwashed, and I was thinking, he can't do no wrong. But as you can see, since I'm sitting here, I was all wrong.
Now, many in the T.M. Landry community say they feel swindled out of time, money, and ironically, an education.
Some of America's most exclusive schools face a fresh review of how race is used in college admissions. One estimate shows more than 43% of incoming students at Ivy League schools were minorities in 2015. That's up from 37% in 2010. The Trump administration is now investigating a series of complaints against Harvard, claiming it puts Asian American students at a disadvantage. In an interview you'll see only on CBS This Morning, Tony DeCopel spoke to an Ivy League president who says race should indeed be part of the admissions process. Tony, good morning.
Good morning. Earlier this year, documents revealed Princeton admission officers discussing race and ethnicity of potential students in stark, sometimes uncomfortable terms. Princeton president says it's a controversial process to be sure, but he also says a race-conscious approach is necessary.
If we wanted to, we could take students who had only perfect GPAs and only perfect board scores and fill a class with them.
Princeton President Chris Eisgruber will soon welcome a new freshman class packed with some of the best students in America. But every year, his admissions officers are considering more than just academics.
Let's be clear about this. As part of our policy, we do take race and ethnicity into account in building a diverse campus.
The Supreme Court has ruled repeatedly that race is an acceptable factor in college admissions.
We want our students to go out in the world and have an impact in a multicultural and diverse society. And to produce those kinds of students, we need to have a diverse student body on this campus.
But a group called Students for Fair Admissions is accusing elite colleges of discriminating against Asian American and white students, using illegal caps on enrollment and higher academic standards for admission. In a Washington Post op-ed, the group's president, Edward Blum, writes that racial preferences punish better qualified individuals and pit Americans against one another.
I had a 2230 in SAT, not a perfect score, but still not bad. I had a perfect score in ACT, as well as a 4.67 GPA, I believe.
In 2012, Michael Wang applied to almost every Ivy League school, but was only accepted to one.
Had I been African American or Latino, I might have gone to more schools. I'm not even sure myself.
In 2015, federal civil rights investigators reported no evidence that Princeton University used separate admissions processes, reviews, or tracks by race. But according to documents released this spring, admissions officers did discuss applicants in racial terms. No cultural flavor, reads one review of an Hispanic applicant. Very few African Americans with verbal scores like this, reads another.
Can you guarantee that Asian American and white applicants are not being held to a higher standard than other groups?
Yes, I can guarantee that all of our students are held to an equal standard. It's tough to get into Princeton, and it's tough to get into our other Ivy colleges, regardless of what group you're from, but everybody gets a fair shake.
Harvard also stands by its policy to consider race to enroll a diverse class of students. In a statement to CBS News, the university told us Harvard's admissions process considers each applicant as a whole person, and we review many factors consistent with the legal standards established by the U.S. Supreme Court.
I can make new antibiotics. I can make computers survive aquatic conditions. I know how to run the business, and I can make you want to buy a product. Movers, shakers, and producers. Me and my friends understand the future. I see the strings that control the system. I can do anything with no resistance, because I can lead a nation with a microphone, with a microphone, with a microphone. And I can split the atom of a molecule, of a molecule, of a molecule. My reach is global, my tower secure, my cause is noble, my power is pure. I can hand out a million vaccinations, or let them all die in exasperation. Have them all heal from the lacerations, have them all killed by assassination. I can make anybody go to prison, just because I don't like them. And I can do anything with no permission. I have it all under my command, because I can guide a missile by satellite, by satellite, by satellite.
And I can hit a target through a telescope. Through a telescope. Through a telescope. And I can.
So we were talking, Nathan, off the air maybe a week ago about this, I guess you could call it a private school in Louisiana that was promoted to national attention through a series of viral college acceptance videos. This basically looks like it was the school's marketing. The school backed that up, boasting 100% college acceptance rate. They were targeting a lot of top tier schools like Ivy League schools, Harvard, Princeton, Yale. And the population of this school was mostly kids from distressed backgrounds, inner city, poor area, huge minority population. Then there was a New York Times piece about the school, an investigative piece, and they uncovered everything from physical abuse and emotional abuse of students to forgery on the college admissions process. So we see something that looks incredibly promising as far as an alternative school taking a different approach, being successful with a population of kids failed by the public schools pretty much throughout the 20th century, even more so than most people are failed by public schools. And you brought this topic to my attention. You had seen a couple of videos about it and you wanted to have a conversation about it. So I wanted to ask what your interest in this particular subject was.
Yeah, so we were talking off the podcast, obviously, we were talking on the phone. I had just saw a video by a gentleman, I think his name is Matt Christensen.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about it. And so then I watched a couple other videos about it and did a little bit of researching. And the main reason that I wanted to get your take on it was because you obviously are a proponent of alternative education models, and I as well am. And it seemed like a lot of the promise that this T.M. Landry model was promoting are things that I'm 100% on board with.
Indeed.
But then when I started looking at it, I saw a lot of the same shortcomings. So I wanted to talk to you about how do we, as people who are trying to build a better model, not fall victim to the same problems that plague, or even worse problems, undiscovered problems that plague the current model of education.
Absolutely. So before we go any further with that, let's kind of inventory that promise, because there might be people in your audience who don't know much about my educational philosophy and vice versa, even though they're pretty identical. And, you know, you've been a listener to School Sucks for a long time, so you know our angle. But just for people who are unfamiliar, when we talk about a promising alternative educational environment, what T.M. Landry was promoting, or at least signaling, and, you know, people came in and did stories about the schools, and how much of this was a performance is hard to tell. But we're talking about learning environments that are student-led. This is self-directed learning, using the intrinsic motivation of students, not, you know, from the top down handing out a curriculum that isn't really customized to individuals. Teachers and mentors, this is something that I like. It makes a lot of people nervous, but teachers and mentors who didn't jump through the state hoops to be, you know, qualified to teach, people who are there more likely out of a passion for helping kids like this, no textbooks, kids teaching each other, older kids mentoring younger kids. These are a lot of positive aspects of alternative education. They all seem to be in place in T.M. Landry. The problem is, I think the creator of the school, who, spoiler alert, was running a scam, was trying to fit it into the current context of education, which is about funneling people into college, right? Because there's this myth that opportunity for career and success and advancement and the right job all begins in the 13th grade in America, which is college admissions and then getting a four-year college degree. And we've seen all of these movements recently about college for everyone and, you know, state schools being free. So free college admission. And that is the sort of leveling of the playing field of opportunity. So the T.M. Landry model, while it has many things that we like as far as pedagogy or lack thereof, a top-down pedagogy, is actually just a sort of feeder or catering to the problematic system as it exists right now.
Yeah. And I was sympathetic to this because I actually went to an alternative high school. I was kicked out of I'll just say I was not the best high school student. And so I was kicked out of a bunch of the traditional high schools. Hmm. And it ended up being that I could only be, there was only one school in town that would accept me, and it was an alternative high school. And it was a little less strict, and there was less people that went there, and the teachers were more one-on-one. They were more, how can we tailor your education experience towards you? Again, I'm a high school dropout, so I didn't finish going to high school at this high school either, but I definitely got more of an understanding of self-directed learning. And I feel like if I hadn't gone to that high school, I probably wouldn't have gone on to become the person that I am today, which I credit that as being good. But that high school also got in trouble. The principal of that high school also got in trouble for money laundering and accused of running a scam high school as well. So when this story broke, it kind of hit more than just one note with me. But a lot of the things that we complain about in regular school that you already mentioned and a lot more seemed to be covered. It seemed like those bases were covered with TM Landry. And yet now you mentioned that it ended up being, you said, spoiler alert, it was a scam. I'd like to touch on why it was a scam, why people why it ended up coming out after this investigation that the school was not actually providing a good service for the students involved. Because from the outside, looking at it, they had 100% acceptance rate into college. They were helping people from downtrodden communities. They were helping predominantly Black and Hispanic minority communities. And it was kind of a shock to me when it came out. The guy and the lady that were running it ended up being accused of running a scam educational model.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard to say, right? So there's a lot we don't know about the intentions of the Landrys, the married couple that actually started this school. It is very possible they had some kind of passion for uplifting talented young kids from really difficult backgrounds and giving them some opportunity they wouldn't have had. At that point, getting that endorphin rush of being able to do that with a couple of kids, they created a model where they would pretend to do it with a whole bunch of other kids. You know, in the market, people recognize needs and they create products to address those needs or solve certain problems that people have. And people can make those same identifications and then just run a scam. So in several ways, the outcome of this school, regardless of what the intentions of the Landrys were when they started, it was predatory against parents. It was predatory against charity, right? Because a lot of the funding came from charity. They got no state funding. They got no federal funding. But the promise is the escape of the failure, right? Escaping from the failure of the public system where so many of these kids had been so underserved. Their parents, probably their grandparents, had been underserved in the public schools. So the promise is kind of what they're marketing. And maybe in the beginning, they could deliver on that with a handful of kids. And then they started to... one of the interesting things that the New York Times piece talks about is the test scores were legitimate. Like if you run a school like this, you can't administer these standardized tests like the SAT or the ACT yourself. You still have to go to a testing center to do those tests. So kids were legitimately scoring. I think their average score on the ACT test was 28 out of 36, which is above average and pretty desirable as far as lots of college admissions are concerned. So they were getting these high test scores. A lot of the kids went on to college and revealed that, like, well, if this wasn't covered on one of these tests, I didn't know it. They were basically drilled for the test so they could have a metric to use coupled with their hardship story that in some cases were legitimate and in some cases they were exaggerated. This is another exposure from the New York Times article, is that Landry was like even changing stories about the relationships that kids had with their parents to make it sound like they'd overcome more obstacles, which is obviously a story that a lot of higher education's admissions people like. And we'll get into that in more detail. But before I go any further, I want to make sure that I'm answering your question.
My question was the accusations, and I think that you did, the accusations that came out. And I think the biggest two that I saw were the ones that you covered. Number one, not educating for a full broad education, only educating to pass the test.
Mm-hmm.
And then number two, the falsifying of backgrounds, the falsifying of records to embellish or flat out lie about some of the kids' backgrounds. Those were the two things that came out and really left a sour taste in my mouth because, like I said, the promise of students teaching students, the promise of being able to learn in an environment that is tailored towards your needs, the promise of a school that isn't regulated, because you mentioned they weren't taking money from the state, they weren't taking money from the federal government, so they weren't having to meet the same regulations, but it seemed like they were putting out a higher degree. Those are all things that us as free market anarchists were always like, hey, yeah, get rid of the regulations and we'll get a better product. And so the promise that I saw when I initially saw it was, oh, here's a school who's not taking money from the state, who's not regulated by the state, and yet they're creating a better product. They're churning out higher quality educated kids. And so I was super excited about it. And then I saw the second half of the story and it just crapped all over my narrative. So as somebody who's got this political ideology, I'm having to come face to face with the fact that maybe, at least in this particular instance, I jumped the gun on thinking that my ideals would create a better product.
Well, and I think that another piece of this too is you talked about going to an alternative school that was kind of a scam, right? And the people who ran the school wound up getting in trouble for various schemes. You were the kind of student that I worked with when I was a teacher. I worked in a boarding school and then a day school for kids who had been kicked out of the surrounding public schools. The people who ran this school wound up in trouble with the IRS and the FBI for a variety of schemes. And I think in both of those cases, those schools were probably getting public funding. I know the school that I worked for got funding from a variety of states to basically become the guardian for the students who went there, especially if it was a boarding school. So, and this also included darker things like these kids are on Medicaid and they wind up on a bunch of drugs as a result of that. So something really pernicious that I've seen in this story, especially the presentation of the T.M. Landry story in the media, has been this bait and switch where they say, well, there goes alternative education. You know, this is what, and there's a lot of linking T.M. Landry to something that it is actually not, a charter school. So T.M. Landry might be a fairly isolated example as far as the lengths that the scheme went to, but it's being connected to alternative education as a whole, because to most people in the public conversation about public school versus alternative school is either private schools or charter schools. So charter schools get public funding, and that arrangement welcomes a variety of schemes like the ones that we're talking about. Right? Because when there are no good stewards of public money, and there's a lot of corruption and exploitation when public money is delivered this way into, finger quotes, private hands. So T.M. Landry is kind of a separate thing that is benefiting from the current school problems in every way except the funding, right? It's saying the schools have failed you. This population of inner city minority kids, public school has failed you. Look at how bad the public schools are. So we're offering this kind of opportunity. And the other piece of that is they're sort of exploiting the hope that people have in higher education opening doors. So even though they're not taking the money from the state, they are beneficiaries of the corruption and the failure of the system as it exists. And then the media is getting what they want because they're saying, oh, let's grab T.M. Landry and use it as an example of everything that's not public school. See what happens when you don't have regulation. See what happens when you don't have oversight. And all of these articles were very gleeful in their revelation that T.M. Landry was not regulated because it didn't take funding. And, you know, the absence of state oversight was at least a partial creator of this problem, of this exploitation. So T.M. Landry is more of an isolated incident. And that's not to say, I think it would be unfair to say that there aren't other schools that, or, you know, again, are these even really schools? What does that mean? There aren't other institutions or operations that are scams like this, also exploiting people's hopes and exploiting people's fears and exploiting parental fear of failure or fear of a lack of opportunity for their children, and really can't deliver anything authentic. What we know about T.M. Landry was they were getting kids high test scores and they were getting kids into Ivy League schools. And I guess for a while before the New York Times came along, that was enough for people to just overlook anything else that was questionable about it. And there should have been a lot that was questionable about it, considering the context of inner city culture and poverty. But then somebody comes and does a television expose on the school, and the kids have college textbooks, and they're just like, oh, we just, you know, we take the books we want and we teach ourselves and we teach each other. There maybe should have been some conversation about, like, well, how did that happen? How did you learn to do that? Why do you want to do that? And that seemed to be missing because people liked this underdog story, right? So the same way college admissions officers love these underdog stories.
So I want to kind of pivot the conversation in a way that might not be comfortable for some of the listeners out there. But we're going to talk about race for a minute because it is a relevant part of this conversation. You were mentioning what college administrators are looking for, and you were talking about how doctoring their background stories made them more appealing to the people that would decide on whether people were admitted to these Ivy League schools or not. And T.M. Landry boasted a 100% enrollment rate, 100% of their students that applied for some very prestigious colleges were accepted. There's a discussion going on right now. I think actually Harvard is actually being sued by some Asian students that were not permitted because of their skin color. And this idea of creating different expectations for people based off of skin color and creating different standards for people based off of skin color and how that played into the whole dynamic of T.M. Landry and the educational system as a whole.
All right. So the backstory on what's happening at Harvard and Yale is the Secretary of Education under Trump, Betsy DeVos, has part of the policy changes that they wanted to make actually emboldened this lawsuit, where they said it was discriminatory to favor or factor in race in the admissions department. And I think I have both the statements, response statements from Harvard and Yale on this issue, right? So they are choosing to defy this. And just to, as a testament to how important this aspect of admissions is, or diversity, and this is something that we're going to get into, diversity on the college campus and in the college brochure, that when you, you know, come to harvard.edu, you see an array of different skin colors. I've never even been to Harvard.edu, but I bet if you go there, that's what you will see. This diversity for diversity's sake is very, very important to these institutions, to the point where they are willing to deal with legal trouble to maintain their current policies. So Harvard said, Harvard will continue to vigorously defend its right and that of all colleges and universities to consider race as one factor among many in college admissions, which has been upheld by the Supreme Court for more than 40 years, even though that's threatened now. Yale said, Yale seeks to create a vibrant and varied academic community where our students interact with people of different backgrounds and points of view. Our admissions policies and practices reflect and support this goal. So that's a nice PR statement at the end of a very long process. I mean, do we want to drill down a little bit and talk about the history of this and how it's affected higher education?
Yeah, I do want to.
I said before we started, you called it the low bigotry of, the bigotry of low expectations. Did George W. Bush come up with that, or was that a phrase before he used it? I'm not sure.
I'm going to say it was probably a phrase before he used it.
Or somebody wrote it for him. Yeah, maybe. But I'll go as far as calling it prejudice and white supremacy, and I'll try to back that up. First, just on the surface, to say, as a college admissions board, that we need more black students or we need more students of color, I would call that prejudice, because what expectations do you have of students of color before you meet them, right? Like if I said, oh, I don't want any women here because they're like this, that's clearly prejudice. But to say, I do want this identity group to come here because they will do this, even though it's framed in a positive way, it's still a prejudice, right? I'm still prejudging that these people bring some kind of quality, and that prejudgment might create an expectation that leads to, once that identity group comes to the college, it might lead to failure, it might lead to resentment, as we are seeing all over college campuses, all over America, at least for the last 5 years, with this so-called social justice war. So that prejudice of we need to bring more people in because they will enhance the college environment for who? For the white students? You know, that this becomes some kind of terrarium of multiculturalism? I think that's a really dangerous idea, a really reckless idea. But white supremacy is a bit of a bigger claim. So to talk about the history of this a little bit, we have to go back to slavery. Is that okay? I don't want to get like too off track here, but
that's okay with me.
It's a big subject. So, you know, 300 years ago, slavery exists all over the world. 400 years ago, slavery exists all over the world. Historically, slavery is not racial. Slavery is the result of conquest. So in certain places in the world, going back to like ancient Greece, you could have slaves that look exactly like you, that speak the same language, that have the same culture. In other regional conflicts, you might wind up with slaves that look like you, but don't speak the same language and don't have the same culture. There was a lot of this in Africa where, you know, two warring tribes would fight, one tribe would win, one tribe would enslave the other tribe. And it wasn't until colonial America that slavery took this kind of racial dynamic. So slaves came to the Western world through what's often referred to as the triangle trade. Sometimes there is like a square trade between Africa, the West Indies, and the United States. So slaves are taken from Africa. They're brought to the West Indies. They turn sugar into molasses. The molasses is shipped into the colonies that became the United States, turned into alcohol, sent back to Africa, sent to Europe. And this, there's an economic perpetuation of this system where slavery is no longer about conquest, but now in the United States, it has this real racial dynamic to it. For completely different reasons, happening lateral to the growth of slavery in the United States is the actual birth of the United States. And you have people like Thomas Jefferson, a slave owner himself, writing the founding documents of the country saying all men are created equal. There you find a contradiction to be resolved, right? Thomas Jefferson owns people while saying all people are created equal. And the resolution is often referred to as scientific racism. So Thomas Jefferson, and I learned this actually from Thaddeus Russell, it's in his book, A Renegade History of the United States, wrote some of the initial tracts on this idea of the inferiority of black people, that there was a justification for white people in the United States to own black people kind of as their caretakers because they needed it. And biology, 18th century biology, back that up. 18th century science, back that up, according to Thomas Jefferson and other apologists for slavery. So this was perpetuated through the 1800s. It was obviously amplified in all of the debates around the Civil War. And it continued into the 20th century. Lots of the science, I'm using air quotes again, that people on the alt-right talk about actually came from the first couple decades in the 20th century. Books like Passing of the Great Race and other attempts to create a racial hierarchy. That was all scientific racism. And the inferiority relationship that grew out of the colonial slave condition was justified because of biological inferiority. At the turning point of this, especially in higher education, was World War II. When, you know, by the early 20th century, there were actually conversations on the left amongst progressives in higher education about sterilizing black people, about eugenics. And after these academics got to see this utopian vision of sterilization and eugenics in practice in Nazi Germany, they changed their tune by the 1950s. And what was scientific racism turned into what is often called racial liberalism, which is still carries over this idea of inferiority and separateness. But now it has a paternalism to it, that we have to use our whiteness, which is today called white privilege, to care for these people and uplift them. So there's certainly an angle of cultural imperialism there, right? White supremacy. We are better, so we have to help. And this really, really took hold in higher education, where it just became this almost unconscious process of trying to funnel disadvantaged people into higher education to create opportunity without really evaluating what the costs would be to these people. So I've known people who worked at Ivy League schools like Dartmouth and said, you know, these kids come here, they come from a completely alien culture, they're transplanted into this world, they don't feel at home, they feel almost like props. You know, they're just sort of there as a kind of dressing to make it look enlightened and diverse and multicultural. And for a lot of these students, that creates a tremendous amount of resentment. And the outward action of those feelings, I think, has a lot to do with what we've seen in college culture over the last 5 years. This idea of, what do they call it, institutional racism or structural racism. So these individual examples of maybe something bad happening to a Black person or a Hispanic person, and it's all funneled up into this idea of institutional racism, right? Because they're in school, they're learning about arguably the very racist history of the United States, not realizing they don't live in Mississippi in the 50s. It's all just kind of collected into this idea of institutional racism. So they're getting this as information, and then they're seeing this everywhere in their environment, which really isn't hard to believe when you consider the process of getting so many minority students into college is based on the same underlying idea. This racial liberalism is a kind of cultural imperialism. It is a kind of white supremacy, and it is certainly a kind of prejudice. It just has this sort of warm and fuzzy liberal faux enlightenment brushed over it.
Fuck you!
Last month, Evergreen State College in Washington went crazy when a professor of evolutionary biology named Brett Weinstein objected to a day of absence when white students and faculty were asked to voluntarily leave campus. Weinstein branded it a form of racial segregation. A group of student protesters called him a racist. The confrontation incited further protests, debates over free speech, and claims of systemic racism on campus. And things haven't calmed down. Tomorrow, Evergreen will hold its graduation at an off-campus location, 40 miles away.
Would you like to hear the answer or not?
No. Okay.
This is the video, viewed by millions, that put Evergreen State and Weinstein in the national spotlight.
This is not a discussion. You have lost that one.
This is not a discussion. You've lost that one.
Yeah, you've lost that one.
So what are they doing here if they don't want to talk to you?
Well, this is part and parcel of their central mode. They're just simply shutting down somebody that they don't want to hear from.
I am not interested in debate. I am interested only in dialectic, which does mean I listen to you and you listen to me.
Weinstein has taught at Evergreen State for 14 years. He describes himself as deeply progressive, but has been denounced as a racist tool of the alt-right by some students and faculty. Weinstein objected to the day of absence in a formal protest email to colleagues, arguing that, quote, one's right to speak or to be must never be based on skin color. Calls for his resignation followed.
By virtue of the way they constructed this, you were making a statement by being on campus that you were not an ally. And I feel like I am an ally to people of color in their attempt to gain equity.
Do you have any sense at this point of why they want you to resign?
Well, they think that I'm a racist. Because if you stand up against one of these things because you think it's ill-considered, that you will be branded as a racist.
We are here to support. We want to dismantle anti-blackness campus wide.
We just wanted to be like, until you're accountable for these actions, you don't get to teach students at Evergreen. You don't get to spread this problematic rhetoric and instill it in students.
Yes, you're disrupting my class.
So at this point, we would like Brett to be fired. But that isn't happening. The administration is refusing to take action. They're choosing to protect this white, cis male professor over its students.
Later that day, the students held a raucous meeting at which they presented a list of demands, including the disarming of campus police and mandatory sensitivity training for all faculty. It's the one point on which the protesters and Weinstein agree. Evergreen's embattled president, George Bridges, has mishandled the crisis.
I think their concerns are legitimate. They're articulating ideas that have to do with race, ethnicity, power, privilege, and we're taking a look at them.
That's my problem, George. You keep doing these little hand movements or whatever.
Come through.
People were criticizing you for using hand gestures.
Absolutely, they were. And you know, that's
that seems crazy to people from the outside of Evergreen.
It may, but it's noise.
But the noise has been effective.
No, fuck you, George. We don't want to hear a goddamn thing you have to say.
So you have to watch that door, watch all the doors, watch the windows. You need to keep eyes on them. And somebody needs to go in that room real quick to make sure that there's no way to get out.
I mean, essentially sounded like you're being held hostage there. If you were going to go to the bathroom, you had to go with two escorts. Is that true?
That's what the students felt was true. I was going to go to the bathroom.
What do you mean, students?
Well, that's what they said. If you want to go to the bathroom, I was going to go to the bathroom regardless, and they wanted to escort me. I felt very safe there. Why what?
Why did they want to escort you to the bathroom?
I don't know.
Did you ask them?
No, of course not.
Professor Brett Weinstein joins us.
The situation on campus grew even more inflamed after Weinstein went on Fox News. The protesters say his appearance provoked threats from the alt-right.
Although Brett has not personally said, you know, go out and attack these students, go out and threaten these students, that has been the result of his actions. He has incited white supremacists, and he has validated white supremacists and Nazis in our community and in the nation. And I don't think that should be protected by free speech.
We received a threat saying that people will come here and execute every single person I see on campus at that point.
Yeah.
Fuck free speech.
When we're dead, when people die, and you're sitting here like, well, at least they got to practice their free speech. I'm so sorry about it. Your free speech is not more important than the lives of, like, black, trans, femmes, and students on this campus. I'm so sorry. Yes, exactly. Hate to break it to you.
The protests have been effective, but it's unclear if they're widely supported. Many students told us that they've been hesitant to publicly dissent. Kirsten, who also didn't want us to use her last name, is one of Weinstein's students.
I'm afraid of having a nuanced opinion because I'm afraid that my opinions and I will be stigmatized.
It's a rather strange sentence to hear on a university campus. I'm fearful of my nuanced opinion.
So I feel that I do not have the ability to speak if I have disagreements with the methods that are being used in the protests.
There is this issue of what I can say and what I can't say and who's going to dismiss me or demean me for saying it. And that is new in the American discourse.
A student told me that you're a white supremacist.
I'm assuming that students have said lots of things about me. I don't believe I am. I'm
you don't
a white
believe
person.
You are, but you accept that you might be.
No. Well, it depends on what you mean by a white supremacist. What does that mean? I'm a white person in a position of privilege.
Okay. I guess that's part of the confusion for me is the precision of language seems to be lost in a lot of this conversation.
It is.
Bridges has acceded to many of the students' demands, but there's a demand he hasn't given into, that Weinstein be fired. Weinstein won't rule out the possibility that he's taught his last class at Evergreen. But if he comes back to teach next semester, he can expect the protest to continue.
I don't care what happens to Brett anymore. He can go and be racist and be a piece of shit wherever he wants to do that. Hopefully, long term, we can just weed out people like Brett.
So I think I was talking to you before we actually started recording. My brother-in-law is black and he's from Atlanta. And he does a little bit of mixed martial arts, but mainly boxing. We were talking and I was asking him if he went to go see a trainer and that trainer said to everybody that was white in the class, they had to train for 4 hours a day and they had to do 400 pushups. And then he said to the black people in the class, you only have to train for 3 hours a day and you only have to do 300 pushups. Number one, what would that say about the trainer? Would that say that the trainer has his best intentions or would that say that the trainer looks down upon him? And then number two, would that be setting him as somebody who wasn't getting the same strict regimen as the white boxers were getting, would that be setting him up for failure or would that be setting him up for success? And I tied that into lowering the standards, lowering SAT standards for black students versus white students or versus Chinese students. And he came away from it saying, if my trainer did what the colleges are doing, that would be setting me up for failure. That would not be doing me a justice. Another example that I have that made me question this, because I actually used to buy into all of this white savior complex stuff.
Sure.
This was back in my early 20s. I had a friend named Steven. He was going to school here at CSU in Colorado for law. And we were talking about affirmative action and how it was such a great thing. And he stopped me and he was a black guy and he stopped me and he goes, affirmative action sucks. I was like, why? And he goes, because every time I walk into an interview with people, they automatically assume, he said, I study harder. I don't drink. I don't party. I don't do drugs. I study harder than everybody in my class. I legitimately have a higher understanding of the legal system than anybody in my class, even more than most of the white kids in my class. But every time I walk into an interview, the person interviewing me automatically assumes I got in out of my skin color. And if I do get into a good law firm, when somebody who has a major case that they have to have the best lawyer possible, and it comes down to me and maybe an Asian guy, and we're both qualified, they're going to automatically assume I got the job because of my skin color, and the Asian guy had to work harder to get the job. So they're going to want him defending them instead of me. So actually, affirmative action works against me. And that completely changed the way I look at the whole thing. And I don't think that that's something that a lot of people take into consideration.
Because it feels so good to not think about any of that. I mean, so much of modern progressivism, and I think progressivism throughout the 20th century, is to get a kind of policy victory. It's almost like a kind of political Pokemon. Like, you see some little kid playing Pokemon, right? And he's trying to catch them all, right? That's what you do. You catch them all. And I think South Park spoofed this pretty well. You drill down a little bit and you go, well, what are you trying to catch them all for? I don't know. Right. So it's almost like this impulse to just keep chasing these good feelings of policy victories. And there's lots of them like affirmative action, but nobody ever looks beyond that to see the results. And college admissions is the same way. There was a study done a couple of years ago. I think it was the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center. And they looked at 6-year outcomes of race and ethnicity as far as college admissions was concerned. So they had overall numbers. They had Asian, Black, Hispanic, and white. The 6-year outcome means if a person entered college, where, you know, say in 2000, where were they in 2006? So this is focusing on the feelings and the, you know, how exciting and gratifying it is to promote multiculturalism without really asking the hard questions of, like, well, what are the results of this? So the overall numbers for everybody accepted into college in a given year, as far as the 6-year outcomes were concerned, 43% completed at the institution that they started. 12.8% completed at another institution. So right there, the overall numbers show about 56% graduation within 6 years. Another 13.2% were still enrolled, meaning that they were either still pursuing a bachelor degree with, you know, breaks in between, or they had gone on to some form of higher education. And then 30.5% were no longer enrolled. So that means about a third of people overall left without earning any kind of a diploma. Now, because most of the country is white, let's just go into those numbers quickly. They were a little bit above the average. 47.5% completed at the institution they started within 6 years. 14.5% had completed at a different institution. So right there, you've got 60% completion within 6 years. Another 11% were still enrolled 6 years later, probably pursuing a master's degree or a PhD. And 27% were no longer enrolled, meaning basically the dropout rate for whites was 27%. Now, for Black Americans enrolled through the same period, almost 30% had finished at the starting institution. Another 9% had completed at a different institution. So that means about 38% versus, you know, almost 50% for white people had completed within 6 years. The no longer enrolled for Black Americans was 45%. 45% 6 years later, which meant, and that was the highest dropout rate of all these different identity groups surveyed by 10%, 15% above the overall average for all identity groups. So yeah, it feels good opening the doors to higher education to largely either racially, culturally, economically disadvantaged people. But when you ask the question of where are they 6 years later, are they better off? The answer for a lot of those people is no. And the process of even getting to being in that 45% of no longer enrolled 6 years later is also an arduous and frustrating and possibly even traumatizing process, especially when, you know, these kids go into college and they are now basically prey for college professors who want to push these social justice narratives. And obviously there's going to be a high amount of buy-in into these social justice narratives because they seem to match the stories that a lot of these kids have lived, right? So there's that to me is almost predatory in many ways, that their struggles are being exploited to turn them into foot soldiers for the narratives of leftist college professors. And man, this is an anecdote I recognize, but I was a part of the Free State Project in New Hampshire, and we went up and did a rally at Plymouth State College, which was a public school, a public college in New Hampshire, after they had banned guns on campus, which was troubling to a lot of people who support the Second Amendment because it's public land, but you could no longer have guns on public land. So we went up and did a rally, and one former U.S. soldier and another former police officer promoted the event by saying, we're going to show up and open carry on this campus. And it became, there was this media blitz. There were all these trigger warnings before trigger warnings were even a thing. So obviously a counter protest was organized. And we went up, this guy, Derek J. Freeman, and I were trying to interview students who were participating in the counter protest. So we started talking to one student, and he told us that the sign he was holding was made for him. This was a 20-year-old man. The sign was made for him by his college professor. And then he started talking to us. We knew the right questions to ask. So he started saying, well, no, I support guns for hunting. And all of a sudden, this woman appears. And she looks at him and she says, we're having a silent protest today, aren't we? And the kid shuts his mouth.
Hi, I'm recording for the Shire Free Press.
Oh,
just wondering if you'd like to comment on your sign here.
Well, it was made by Robin DeRosa, one of my faculty members, and I think it kind of sums up my point. Please don't bring guns onto my campus.
What's your concern?
I'm concerned about exactly what just happened at Virginia Tech. I'm concerned that our really, really safe campus is going to be kind of demolished and just have a whole different feel about it. It's a very homely place to be, and I just don't think it should be just infected with guns all around campus.
Is everyone with a gun a bad guy?
No, not at all. The hunters are great, and people that...
But we don't really feel safe talking today, so we might want to just... We're having a silent protest, so we hope that you'll respect that.
Excuse me, who
Would
are you?
Like some literature?
I'm recording for the Shire Free Press.
Would you like some literature?
Sure. Who are you?
We're having a silent protest today. Thank you.
Well, I was just talking to this gentleman. Would you like to give me your name?
Yes, Josh Cooley. But
that's great. And does this woman own you, or are you speaking for yourself today?
We're having a silent protest today.
Okay. Well, why the change? Were you not having a silent protest earlier, and now you are?
It's just early in the morning.
Why no reporter?
Okay. Well, have a great day.
Kindergarten, college. It was startling. So, I mean, that was one example on guns. And if you think about the less explicit examples, I mean, maybe they're not all so overt, but these professors get to push these messages in more subtle ways day after day after day. So if a student comes from a disadvantaged background where they've never really been interested in school, they don't, as everybody graduating from public school, just, I mean, this is the case, I think, across the board, probably don't have super strong critical thinking skills. They are sitting ducks for the messaging of left-wing college professors in higher education, and they can be mobilized as a kind of army. And we're seeing a lot of that. We see these protests against people like Milo Yiannopoulos or Ben Shapiro or Gavin McGinnis. And yeah, there's a mob of students there, but the person who goes up and hits somebody with a bike lock or spits in somebody's face, it seems like a lot of the time it's actually a faculty member of the college, right? Mm-hmm. So they're mobilizing this kind of army. And I think this is a really gross form of exploitation. I'm not saying that, you know, it's college professors who are behind the whole thing. It's a very complicated, I told the history very, very quickly. And again, Renegade History of the United States, if you want to learn more, but they're certainly beneficiaries of it as far as pushing an ideology. And students who are mostly minorities, mostly like the people that T.M. Landry is trying to feed into these institutions, are victims. You know, I hate to say it because so much of what's being promoted in higher education is this victim mentality. but they're actually being victimized by being made to feel like they're victims, you know, and having that authoritative voice say, no, you are a victim. And this is now spilling down into the lower levels of school too, right? Because lots of these people who got this victim narrative, they teach now. You know, social justice doesn't end with a bachelor's degree in gender studies. They say, oh, no, you go get a law degree now. You go get a teaching certificate now, and you get back out there in the world and you spread this message. And I've seen it happen to my nieces and nephews in their schools. So, yeah, this is really pernicious. But, you know, just to kind of rein it in to our topic today, it starts with the exploitation of hope. That T.M. Landry situation, I was looking up Louisiana as far as like education statistics go. They're 49th in the country. So they have an easy marketing task ahead of them, right? To say, school failed you. Like, public school sucks pretty much across the board. Yeah, sure, some are better than others and some produce better opportunities than others. But Louisiana is 49th in the country. And those kids have nothing. And I think it's pretty obvious, especially in the inner city, what a failure those schools are. So you have that exploitation of hope, but also perpetuation of college is success, right? So these kids are being pushed into this system that creates all these other problems that I talked about.
Okay, so I'm going to pivot the conversation a little bit, and sure. I'm going to add an anecdotal analogy of my own. So I actually grew up and went to inner city schools. I went to predominantly Black and Hispanic schools. Growing up as a white kid, I was the minority.
I was hoping we would get into this. Yeah, yeah.
So I went to a lot of these inner city schools, and I was taught most of this narrative, this rich people are oppressive, capitalists are holding you down. The only chance that you have for a good future is to graduate and go to college, was kind of the promise that we were all made back in the 80s and 90s. The other one was the whole systemic oppression, the system set up against you. The best chance that you have is to vote for people who will steal from the greedy capitalists and give you money. Like I said, I dropped out of high school. I never went to college. I started learning on my own. I built my own business. I learned my own skills. I entered the marketplace on my own. Now I tend to work for people and get paid a lot more than all of the high school and college graduates around me. I on most of my jobs, I charge between $1 and $500 an hour to work. Sometimes I charge $1,000, $2,000 an hour to work. I see what college is doing and what high school is doing. And this is not racist specific. This is just in general. It seems to me like what these educational systems are doing, they're setting kids up for failure. They're setting kids up to go into the world viewing themselves as victims. They're setting kids up to go into the world viewing the free market system as something that's going to oppress them. Whoever can get the most victim points is the most rewarded. And we see kids coming out of college hating success, hating the successful, hating the wealthy. And if you go into life hating the successful, hating the wealthy, one of the biggest things that I had to overcome from my own programming was this idea that if you were rich, it was because other people had to be poor in order for you to get rich. Or if you had a lot of money, it was because you were exploiting people. So I always prevented myself from making as much money as I could doing what I do by justifying it by saying in the back of my mind, well, it's not right for me to have that much money. It's not right for me to charge the fees that I charge for what I do for people. And so I see a lot of kids coming out of school completely unprepared, even college, coming out with master's degrees, completely unprepared to actually do something in the real world and make a living for themselves. And so whereas high school and college, at least the narrative used to be that these are set up to get you prepared to go out and be successful in the world, it seems like most of the kids coming out of college and high school now are not successful in the world, and they're not being prepared for success in the world, and they're being prepared to actually have mindsets that are going to work against their success, be detrimental and opposed to their own success. So
sure.
I am a big fan of trying to figure out other ways of educating. All of, like I said, I make a lot more money than most of the high school and college graduates that I grew up with, that I know, or that I even work with. And I didn't go through that method. I went through a method of self-education. I went through buying online courses and learning how to market myself and learning how to sell and learning high-paying skills that not very many people have. So that's back to where we started this conversation. I feel like there's a need for alternatives. I feel like there's a need for something outside of what college provides, outside of what high school provides, outside of what public education provides, which is why I was super excited when I saw the T.M. Landry story. But at the same time, how do we create alternatives to an obviously failing system that doesn't fall victim to the same problems the traditional system has fallen victim to?
First of all, just to speak to what you were saying about this sort of inculcation of a victim narrative, I was talking to my mother today. She used to be a teacher, and she's pretty woke on a lot of the things that I talk about on the show. And she was telling me, I have a 12-year-old niece, and she was saying that the new rage at her middle school is needing a therapy animal or having a diagnosis, right? Having some kind of DSM-5. So maybe like we're at an age where high school graduated us and released us out into the world kind of neutral, right? Kind of like, okay, go get a job, right? So it wasn't preparing us for success in any way, but it also wasn't like, and I think this is still more the case in college, it wasn't kicking us back several steps as far as success is, because we have to overcome our own victim mentality. But it sounds like you were getting a little bit of that in high school, but I feel like I graduated just kind of neutral and thoughtless, right? I didn't have, you know, developed thoughts in my head. I just thought, all right, I'll just follow these tracks and see where they go and I'll be pushed along. But it's much worse today for a lot of these young kids. And it's scary to think about where a lot of them will be in 10 years. This question has been put to me several times about alternatives for these types of kids. I worked with this population of students, and the only thing that I saw that was really successful was giving them meaningful things to do, right? And they had to establish what that meaning was. You could be plenty encouraged, and I had to push, right? I really had to push what meaning was. But if there was buy-in about that meaning, they would embrace it. And they would start to exert their own effort and their own enthusiasm and their own attention towards new endeavors. So I'll give an example, and this is kind of a contrast to what was happening at T.M. Landry. I've said this several times in this conversation, that T.M. Landry is just exploiting the current model and its problems, right? Get good standardized test scores and get into college, and that is synonymous with success. I was working with a population of kids. We were debating as to whether or not we could mainstream them back into society when they were done with the school. And that was a question that I started to ask. So just, I've told this story on my show before, but the nutshell version is this. I became the lead teacher of a specialized campus at a boarding school for kids who had at the time, this was in 2002, they were called sexually reactive behavior issues, meaning that they had been sexually abused, and almost like clockwork, when they reached the age of their abuser, they replicated the abuse on a younger child. And they were institutionalized and they were very carefully watched. They couldn't see movies that were rated PG-13. At one point in the dorm, SpongeBob SquarePants was banned because the name of the place was Bikini Bottom and it was considered to be too triggering for some of these kids. Now, that was those were staff decisions, right? And I came in, and after a year of teaching and struggling through what I thought it meant to be a good teacher, which was going around the circle and reading, handing out worksheets, getting filled out worksheets handed back to me, running a structured classroom where students sat in desks and did work and learned things. It was an abysmal failure because those kids couldn't do that. They had too much going on in their own heads. They had too much of their own trauma from, you know, the environments they grew up in, or parental abuse, or abuse of strangers or loved ones. They had all kinds of trust issues. They had really tremendous difficulty with a lot of social interactions. A lot of them couldn't even sleep. You know, like they were insomniacs. They didn't even sleep. So if you think about not being able to sleep and then being, you know, ushered into a classroom at 8 o'clock in the morning with no sleep and being told to do work as you reach a state of delirium in some cases. So I was set up to fail thinking that my job as a teacher is to get them to do work and get them to learn by the traditional metrics of school. They all had IEPs, individualized education plans, where I had to set, you know, bullshit goals for them. Johnny will increase his competency in this state standard subject area by 70% by the conclusion of this school, like things that were never going to happen. And I'm just copying and pasting standards from a list of possible options into some kid's IEP on Microsoft Word and knowing that it was a meaningless process. So after a year of doing this and feeling like an incredible failure, I threw all that out and I met with the people who ran the school, the administrators and the psychologist who oversaw the clinical aspect of the program. And I said, what are we going to do with these kids? What happens when they leave here? Are they going into a padded room? Because that's all we're preparing them for, right? By restricting all of their behavior and making them feel like failures academically all day long. So with their with the support of the psychologists, we loosened all of these restrictions. And I just said, we're going to do a life skills curriculum. And it wasn't like, have a fake job and get a fake house and here's a fake check. There were like simulated aspects to it, but we created a real newspaper. That was their education. There was no math worksheets. There was no books we were reading. They were all employed at the newspaper based on their interests. And then they had a job. And then we produced a real product and it went out to the entire school. And a lot of these kids who were outcasts actually got acceptance and praise for the work they did from other kids who thought this was cool. And I did this to survive. I feel like I've told this story in the past as if it like had some kind of foresight in it or some kind of wisdom in it, but it had none of that. I said, what the hell can I do to not lose my mind in this building this year? And that was the conclusion. And the idea came from something that I thought was cool. And I was like, well, I could sell this. I can be enthusiastic about this. And somehow, you know, I got 20 kids to buy into that idea. And it was a successful year. Later on, much to my delight, I discovered John Taylor Gatto, who's a very smart guy with much more experience than I had at the time, promoting the exact same type of education, where he worked with these inner city kids in a public school. He would get in trouble. He would get his license revoked. They'd put up all kinds of obstacles to stop John Taylor Gatto from letting kids educate themselves. But he would basically just release kids into the world out of public school, sometimes, you know, clearly violating the school's rules. He would put them in trucks with truck drivers and say, go and learn with this truck driver today. And stuff that is, by today's standards, insane. Things that they would take you out of the school in handcuffs for doing if you were a teacher. He was doing to create educational experience for these kids. But what it came down to was meaningful work, meaningful activity, something where there's buy-in, where there's passion, where there's investment, and there's a result. So we can go from so many of these feelings of failure or powerlessness into something that's actually like pride and empowerment. And that's a huge shift for me to experience in 1 year of teaching. And I, you know, I think John Gatto had the same results at the public school he was teaching at in New York City. So that can take a variety of different forms. You know, people have tried to be prescriptive in this area that, you know, success for these kids or the right structure for kids like this, it has to look like this. But I say, if you follow that rule, it could take a lot of different shapes. You know, when kids have really significant behavior challenges, emotional difficulties, when they come from these broken homes or these desperate environments, you know, they tend to operate in more of a survival mode. You know, it seems like when I worked with these kids, their instincts, their desires, in many cases, they were very base. Their obsessions were food and sex. And then a distant third was like music because it was pleasurable, right? So it was all about pleasure cultivation. And that was all the meaning life had because it was very much a survival mindset. I want food. When I'm fed, I don't feel neglected. And when I get sex, I feel loved. So to break it down into two categories of how to impact these kids, you can use fear or you can use love. And the approach seemed to be, for a lot of people, use fear. Use discipline, use sternness. But love can take many forms. It doesn't have to be a hug and I love you and a kiss on the cheek, because it's certainly none of that would have been appropriate where I worked. But kind of trust. You know, I trust you. I believe in you. That resonated with those kids as well. And, you know, when kids are little, yeah, maybe they need a pat on the head. Maybe they need you to put their arm around them so they feel safe. But with these older kids, they understood what was more an act of love than an act of discipline. It's almost like people talked about it like it was dog training. You know, who's the dog whisperer guy, right? You have to be firm. You have to stand over them. You have to raise your voice. You have to set these clear limits. Well, they certainly responded to that, but what they needed was the other thing. And I think that's what they got from John Taylor Gatto, you know, an adult saying, I believe in you and you can do this. And that was actually the most impactful thing for me, was a college professor who said, I don't think you're as stupid as you think you are, Brett. And that really changed my life. You know, that really, because But even when I was 19, 20 years old, I was like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing here. I don't know anything. I'm a dummy. That was confirmed through 12 years of public school. But somebody who would set me free to not only explore the things I wanted to, but would also make me feel like I was worthy of the challenge and capable of overcoming challenges, that went a long way for that turned my life around in a year. And I think that's certainly a possibility for so many of these more impressionable kids. Instead of milling them through, some kind of miracle alternative school where the miracle is they just move on to the 13th grade where most of them will probably fail. And I hate to say that, and I know some of these kids from TM Landry are in college now, and I hope they're successful. I hope they make it through. But it was very exploitative by the Landrys, and you know what they're exploiting is the system that fails these kids as a whole. So there's one alternative. I can elaborate if you need to, even though I just talked for like 10 minutes.
I'm going to ask one more follow-up question to that. Personally, I know that once I started my own business and once I had a reason to start learning again, you mentioned self-directed or having a drive, a personal drive to actually learn things. Those are the things that I've always been able to really dive deep into and actually get a good education in. And once I started my own business, learning how to market, learning how to manage a business, learning how to do copywriting, those things I picked up way quicker than I picked up anything in high school when it was being forced upon me. The other thing that you mentioned was having people trust you, having people have faith in you. We do see now, we see a lot more, a wider variety of educational models now. We see Khan Academy, we see what you do over at School Sucks Project. We see people that are starting online courses, Coursera, there's Kajabi. People can make their own courses and sell courses. A lot of the stuff that I've learned that has turned my business successful came from entrepreneurs who were just teaching other people what they had learned how to do. And no accreditation, no degree came along with it. No classroom came along with it. It was just, hey, I figured out how to do this. This is how you can figure out how to do the same thing. Going forward, where the educational model is actually diverse like this, how much do these things, these lessons that you talked about, self-directed learning, people being driven to actually learn, people feeling like the educators have faith in them, how much is that going to make a difference as we see this kind of automated and less personalized model of education starting to form up on the internet? Because I think there is a good aspect to having an actual teacher there who's rooting for you versus having somebody just say, hey, sign up for this course and you'll get these pre-canned lessons. Right. So we see the education model kind of diverging, but are we going to be able to incorporate, or do we even need to worry about incorporating those things?
I think we do. And I actually think you've done a good job with it. And another person who comes to mind that both our audiences are familiar with is Kevin Geary, which is you kind of build a culture or community around that thing. Right? Like Kevin has done that with Six Figure Grind. Kevin did that with Rebooted Body. You did that with Free Market Squad. I like to think that I could do a better job with it, but I like to think that it's possible with the School Sucks community. Yeah. I mean, mentorship can come out of that community. You know, it doesn't need to be top down. It's great if somebody can create a course or create a project, an educational product, but the people using it, just like a mastermind. It's a kind of accountability. It's a kind of support system, and that can replace a person at the front of the room, right? Especially when you consider everybody is there intrinsically motivated. Everybody is there sharing a purpose, or at least driven by a purpose of their own. People come to Free Market Squad or Six Figure Grind or School Sucks looking for different things, but they're all looking for something, right? They're all motivated from the inside. And I think that provides a support that in many cases would be a replacement for the more face-to-face school that people think is so necessary. I don't think it is. I like peer mentorships. But somebody also had to create that, right? So there still is an instructor in a form or somebody who's inspiring the learning. But then a community takes shape and it goes from there.
So overall, let's close the show with this. Overall, what are your main thoughts on what we can do to provide a better education system and how technology, how innovation, and how just necessity are going to be changing the education system as we move forward.
Well, I'm going to ask for some clarification on your question. Providing a better education system is definitely not language that I would use. I mean, yeah, there is going to be something going on out there called school, and people are going to use the word education interchangeably with that. I'm not interested in that. I'm not interested in fighting that. I'm not interested in participating in any kind of system. You know this about me, but just for the people in the audience who don't, I think it is an individual pursuit. And when people find reasons they can come together and work together, that is beneficial. But the system, to me, implies top down. It implies force. It implies standardization. And those are some, but not all, of the problems with the current state of schooling, which people refer to, I would say erroneously, as learning and as education. Making a new website sucks when you're in my space. And every time you do a Google image search or a Shutterstock image search for learning, all you get is crap from school, right? Because culturally, those things are so synonymous. So, what we try to do is separate them. And if people are individual learners, I think they will find the right people and they'll find the right resources. Is that a system? I don't think so.
Going forward, what do you see as, because I honestly don't see the current model lasting. I see it crumbling. I see it falling apart. It's not providing the desired outcome. It has to be replaced with something. What do you see as possible replacements for what we've been glued to for the last couple hundred years?
Okay, so I think the lower levels of education, the K-12 public schools, will exist as long as the state does, right? No matter how bad they get. Higher education, because it does have more of a voluntary dimension to it, you'll see more and more opt-outs from that. And I'm really hoping that models like Praxis, Praxis is a kind of career training and mentorship program. It basically has these two components to it. There's a professional development coursework, and this all happens in less than 2 years. While college is taking 4, 5, 6 years for most people, I think Praxis is an 18-month program. So obviously, it's a lot less money as well. I think the entire program costs $11,000, but you can make that money in a professional training, a paid professional training, with a company that, if you complete the program, will offer you a job with a starting salary of $50,000. You know, now that's job training, and maybe that's where a person's career begins. But through that professional development, my understanding of Praxis is that people are also getting a lot of what they need to know to go on from that first job, maybe after 3 or 4 years, and become an entrepreneur. You know, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't think there's anything wrong with an introduction to the work world that involves working for somebody else who's built a successful business. So that kind of mentorship and that apprenticeship model is getting people into the real world sooner, which is the same idea that I was talking about John Taylor Gatto promoting in the 80s and the 90s, you know, in the inner city New York schools, getting people out and having real world experiences and being able to rub shoulders with people who've already been successful in places where, you know, these younger people want to get to. That's the future. And I think technology makes that a lot easier. And as much as I want to see Praxis succeed in all kinds of ways, I hope they have a lot of competition very soon.
Awesome. Brett, thank you so much for having this conversation with me. For my listeners, if they want to go and check out your work, where can they go?
My website is schoolsucksproject.com. But since we talked a lot about John Taylor Gatto, I would also recommend schoolsucksproject.com/John Taylor Gatto, where you can see a video series that I made. It's a good introduction to our work, and it covers a lot of pretty revelatory topics from his book, The Underground History of American Education. So I think once people start to understand the politics and designs and history behind the public school system in the United States, it's a good push into thinking more seriously about alternatives to that system. So if you need a little encouragement taking education more seriously, and I really think that if people are more liberty-minded or more entrepreneurial-minded, You need to recognize the school system as a pretty big obstacle, right? Because almost everybody's going through it. People are coming out with pretty uniform mindsets, not just politically or socially or philosophically, but also entrepreneurially. And that's something that we definitely both want to change. So schoolsucksproject.com/JohnTaylorGatto, G-A-T-T-O. And Nathan, can you share the same information with my audience for people who want to learn more about your work?
Yeah, absolutely. You can check out more of my podcast over at NathanFraserShow.com. And if you want to learn more about the Free Market Squad, and if you want to learn more about setting up an online business, how to write great sales copy and how to create funnels for your business so that you can make more money and not have to be dependent on a corporate 9-to-5, then check out my work over at copyandfunnels.com. So NathanFraserShow.com and copyandfunnels.com.
Awesome. You know, I do have the advantage of being in a mastermind with you. So I get to see a lot of this work that you do and a lot of this advice that you give. And it's been really helpful and it's really awesome. So I highly recommend, if people are in need of these services, to go check out Nathan's work.
Awesome. Thank you, Brett. A fantastic conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Likewise. Thank you.